לתשומת ליבכם, התוכנית הבאה היא תוכנית מוקלטת, ועשויות להישמע במהלכה התראות והתייחסות לאירועים ביטחוניים שהראו בזמן שידורה הראשון. האזנה טובה.
Listening to the English language news of Kan, the Israeli Public Broadcasting Corporation.
It's 8 p.m. in Israel, Saturday, April 13, 2024. Good evening. This is Arye O'Sullivan with the news. Here are the main stories we covered over the weekend. Security forces are beefed up in Judea and Samaria after terrorists murdered a 14-year-old Jewish shepherd boy and clashes erupted between Palestinians and Jewish settlers. A man is wounded from an explosive drone hitting Kibbutz Hanita in the Western Galilee. Iranian commandos take over a container ship with Israeli links in the Persian Gulf. The families of hostages are calling for the end of the war now, if that will win their freedom of the hostages. The IDF has beefed up its forces in Judea and Samaria and deployed more border police units to head off disturbances and conflicts between Jews and Palestinians after the murder of Binyamin Achimeir, a 14-year-old Jewish shepherd in the Shiloh region. Large forces of the IDF, the Shin Bet, and about 2,000 volunteers participated in searches for the shepherd boy who went missing yesterday while grazing his flock. Achimeir's brutally tortured body was discovered this afternoon by an IDF drone, and security officials said it was a terrorist attack. While searches were underway for the perpetrators, thousands of Jewish residents in the settlements nearby descended on the town of Al-Mayarir. Palestinians said that the settlers burned 15 vehicles and two houses and destroyed all the sheep pens. Violent clashes erupted, and a Palestinian was killed by IDF fire, and several were injured. An Israeli was moderately wounded by a Palestinian gunshots, and others were injured by stones thrown by the Palestinians. Rioting also spread to other villages, such as Kusra near Nablus and Mazra near Ramallah. In the north, an explosive-laden drone launched from Lebanon struck inside Kibbutz Hanita in the Western Galilee this afternoon. An IDF reserve soldier, a member of the emergency squad on the kibbutz, was seriously wounded by the explosion. He was evacuated to a hospital, and his family has been notified. A heavy barrage of about 40 rockets were fired last night from Lebanon at communities in the Galilee. Some were intercepted, and others fell in open areas. There were no casualties reported. Earlier, air defenses intercepted two Hezbollah explosive drones that crossed over from Lebanese territory. In other news, amid heightened alert over the threatened Iranian strike on Israel, commandos of the Iranian Revolutionary Guards commandeered a container ship flying a Portuguese flag near the Straits of Hormuz. The Associated Press posted a video showing the commandos rappelling down ropes from helicopters onto the ship's deck. The British military's United Kingdom Maritime Trade Operation said the vessel was seized in the Gulf of Oman off the Emirati port of Fujairah. It has reportedly been brought to Iranian waters. The vessel is the Portuguese-flagged Ares, a container ship associated with Zodiac Maritime, which is part of the Israeli billionaire Eyal Ofer's Zodiac Group. Zodiac declined to comment. The Indian government contacted the Iranian authorities to ensure the safety and well-being of 17 Indian crew members who were on the ship and to bring about their release as soon as possible. As of this moment, there has been no comment from Iran on the incident. The fighting in the Gaza Strip following the alerts that were activated last night in the Sderot area, the IDF spokesman announced that three launches from the Gaza Strip were successfully intercepted. IDF forces attacked the launch area with artillery fire. It was also reported that fighter jets of the Air Force attacked and destroyed three launchers, including about 20 rockets ready to be launched into the center of the country. In the past day, the Air Force attacked more than 30 terrorist targets throughout the Gaza Strip, including military buildings and anti-tank launchers. The abductees. Some family members of the hostages are calling for Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to be replaced by a, quote, responsible leader, in their words, who will bring about a deal for the release of the abductees. In a joint statement issued this evening, it said that time is running out, and if the price of returning their loved ones was ending the war, then Israel should do so. More violence in the Arab sector, 3 dead and several injured in a series of severe violent incidents. In Usafia in the north, 2 men in their 30s were shot dead. The police opened an investigation. In a shooting in the village of Kafar Yassif in the western Galilee last night, 1 person was killed and 4 were injured, 2 seriously and 2 moderately. Among the seriously injured is a toddler about 3 years old. The background to the incident is still unclear. And finally, an unusual event in the national park, Mamshit in the Negev. A wolf tore a hole in a tent set up in the camping site, bit a sleeping girl, and dragged her out. The girl's father woke up and chased the wolf away, but the wolf escaped. Rangers from the Nature and Parks Authority are looking for the wolf. The girl was taken to Soroka Hospital in Beersheba for treatment and supervision. And the overnight camping site has been temporarily shut. Taking a look at the weather, and no real change in temperatures tomorrow. On Monday, there may be local rains in the Golan Heights and in the mountains during the afternoon. That's our report for the latest news from tonight. I'm Aryeh O'Sullivan wishing you a Shavua Tov, and now we bring you our pre-recorded Week in Review program. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to the English language news of Khan, the Israeli Public Broadcasting Corporation.
Good evening and Shavua Tov. This is Aryeh O'Sullivan with a look at some of the stories we covered this week. Amid a threat of an Iranian strike on Israel, U.S. President Joe Biden has promised Israel ironclad support amid concerns that Tehran will respond to last week's attack on the Iranian embassy compound in Damascus that it blames on Israel. Our reporter Mark Weiss spoke with Dr. Thamar Gindin, an expert on Iran from Haifa University's Esri Center for Iran and Persian Gulf States, and asked her how the possibility of an Iranian strike on Israel is viewed in Iran.
We're hearing 3 types of messages from Iran. The leadership says there will be a very severe revenge, and Tehran is tasked, a hard revenge. They don't say what. They say we will revenge at a time, place, and manner that you don't expect, or that they say that you don't think. So we don't really know what they have in mind. We don't know if they have anything in mind. The people also doesn't think they have something in mind. From the people, we see a few reactions. There are the ones who are even more fundamental than the government, and they say, why do you only talk? You never avenge. You haven't avenged even Qasem Soleimani, who was made Shahid, or as the opposition said, was made Qasem Cutlet. It was 4 years ago, and you didn't avenge it yet.
This is on Iranian social media you're talking about?
On Iranian social media and on the press, because this is not something that the government doesn't like. They like this kind of criticism. The criticism they don't like is only on social media, which is we see a lot of like graphics that make chicken cutlets or meat cutlets with the faces of the Shahids. They really like calling it kotletchod, became cutlet, and laughing and rejoicing at these high-ranking people who were made shahids or cutlets because they really hate the government. And on top of that all, it was a very beloved holiday last Monday. It's called Sizda Bedar. 13 out, 13 outside. They go on picnics. It's the last day of the new year. They go on picnics. They sing. They dance. They eat. And the government tried to stop that because it was Ramadan, which is the month of fasting. And besides that, it was also the day that Imam Ali, one of their most important prophets, became Shahid. So they say it's a day of mourning. You shouldn't go to the parks and dance and eat and everything. Of course, the people did it anyway. The government also tried to stop that by closing the gates of parks that have gates. And there was police or law enforcement on the way to parks that don't have gates. But we still saw on social media that the people did go out. So what the holiday gift that Israel gave them, according to foreign media, of course.
We also saw a video clippage of football fans booing at a stadium when the regime wanted a minute's silence for those killed in the Damascus attack.
Right, it was an Esteghlal game. Esteghlal is one of the top football clubs, soccer clubs. It's one of the top soccer clubs in Iran. And there was also a game in October when they tried to have a minute of silence for the Shahids in Gaza, and the crowd booed and jeered and, you know, blew horns. But the regime didn't learn from that, and they tried to also make a similar one for the Shahids from Syria. But the crowd doesn't do what it's told. It does what it feels.
Do you think it's possible? Do you think it's possible that despite the bluster and the threats, that there will be no response from Iran this time, either directly or via proxies?
We don't know, because when they say that they will revenge in the time and place that they want, they say that they like to serve their revenge cold. We actually don't know where and when. What I think is that they do their operations when they have a chance, and then they attribute it to revenge for this and that killing. But it's things that are planned way in advance and are carried out when there's an opportunity. I do think that maybe one of the reasons that they don't succeed in these revenges is that, you know, there's a high alert. For example, closing the embassies means they can't attack the embassies. So I don't think it shouldn't be done. I don't think we should be uncautious. But I don't think they will really there will be something in the near future.
What about those reports yesterday that Tehran had closed its airspace, at least temporarily?
If it was reported only in one news agency and I didn't see any echoes in social media, it probably means that it wasn't a real thing. Maybe they're preparing it. Maybe they're preparing, an item just in case it happens, because yesterday the foreign minister of Israel tweeted that if the Islamic Republic attacks from Iran, then Israel will attack in Iran. That could be one of the reasons. According to the deleted item said that it was for a military drill, which is also possible, but I don't recall ever closing the airspace of Tehran for a military drill.
The very strong Israeli counter threats to Iran that Israel will hit Iran if Iran attacks Israel. Are these threats reported in Iran? Do the Iranian public know about this?
Yes, they do. I did see major headlines of it. It was also a tweet in Persian, so Iranians could see it in the original. Another thing about the revenge, they're not very fast with revenge, because they also like watching Israel panic. And one of the speakers of the past week said, look, the Israelis closed 27 embassies and they're so afraid, and look, Israelis are the most chicken of all human beings, even though we don't consider them human.
Dr. Tamar Gindan, an expert on Iran from Haifa University's Esri Center for Iran and Persian Gulf States. A protest took place this week opposite the prime minister's residence in Jerusalem under the slogan, "We demand victory, Rafah now." We spoke with one of the organizers, Tzvika Moore, whose son Eitan was a security guard at the Nova Music Festival and has been held in Hamas captivity for more than 6 months.
We want to say to the Israeli government to defeat Hamas. We paid enough. The Israeli people paid enough for the terrorists, not only on October 7th, but in the past 100 years. And now it's time to Hamas to pay. and we want Israel to win this war and to release our hostages, okay, by defeat Hamas.
So you're demanding that the government order a strike on Rafah immediately?
Yes, immediately. They should do it before, but now it's time to get in Rafah and continue the war.
But the government claims the operation in Rafah is on hold temporarily in order to give the current contacts on a ceasefire chance.
We think that you cannot negotiate with Hamas without the war. You have to do both things, okay? Negotiate and continue the war, because you have to press Hamas. And when you go into Rafah, you are pressing Hamas. And if you will press Hamas, okay, you can achieve a better deal.
Some experts argue that military pressure on Hamas will not work, and not only will it not work, it might actually endanger the lives of the hostages. How do you respond to this?
Yes, we have talked with some specialists, and they told us that we cannot achieve any deal without the war, without continuing to press Hamas. Okay, and I think that it makes sense. Okay, because Hamas have a time; they're not in a rush. They want to achieve a better deal for them, and in purpose to get a good deal, if you can say that, to the people of Israel, not only for the hostages, you have to keep your press. Okay.
In recent weeks, many of the families of hostages have been joining demonstrations calling for new elections and to bring the government down. They believe there will be no deal as long as Prime Minister Netanyahu remains in power. How do you respond to that?
I think that it's a mistake because there are only 6 or 8 families that cooperate with these demonstrations. Okay. The majority of the families didn't go to this demonstration because they think that if you demonstrate against your government within the war, you are causing a damage for the war and to the hostages. So it's only a few families. That's it.
Tell us a bit about Eitan.
Eitan was a security guard in the Nova Festival and saved a dozen of people at the beginning of the attack morning. And we heard that Eitan was kidnapped about 12 o'clock at noon.
And since then you've heard nothing?
We heard before the first deal, we heard from the intelligence that Eitan is alive and before the first deal. Yes, Eitan is our oldest son. Eitan has 7 brothers and sisters, and we all love him and miss him, of course. And Eitan has a lot of friends all over the country. Eitan is a very tough guy, very funny guy, and has a great responsibility for all his brothers and sisters and friends and the people of Israel. Eitan wants Israel to be tough with the terrorists. It's something that Eitan told us a lot of times in the previous years, and we sure that Eitan is strong wherever he is now, and Eitan is strengthening the other hostages that with him, and we hope and we pray that that Eitan and all the hostages will come back to us.
Together with you, we hope and pray you'll see him shortly.
Thank you.
Tzvika Moore, one of the organizers of the protests opposite the Prime Minister's residence in Jerusalem, whose son Eitan was a security guard at the Nova Music Festival and has been held in Hamas captivity for more than 6 months. This week saw a surge in humanitarian aid being delivered to Gaza through Israel this week. IDF spokesperson Rear Admiral Daniel Hagari issued an English language statement about Israel's efforts to facilitate the entry of aid into Gaza.
I want to share the next phase of our humanitarian operations. We have worked together with countries and international organizations from around the world to develop new and improved measures to increase the flow of aid to Gazan civilians by land, sea, and air. Over the last 6 months, since the October 7th massacre, the IDF has been fighting the Hamas terrorist organization in Gaza, while Hamas continues to hold 133 hostages and use Gazans as human shields. Israel continues to facilitate the entry of humanitarian aid into Gaza and find new ways to increase this effort. We are constructing the Northern Crossing, a new land crossing from Israel into Northern Gaza, to enable more aid to flow directly to civilians in the areas that have been challenging for the trucks to access. These new measures enable us to bring more aid and trucks destined for Gaza from overseas, including the Via Land crossing with Jordan, where we expect 58 trucks a day to pass through. Following the cabinet's decision, we have worked with international partners to bring in more aid from the sea via the port of Ashdod, after which it will be transported down to the crossings into Gaza. The combination of these new measures means that we expect the daily average of trucks of food, water, medicine, and shelter supplies going into Gaza to go up gradually from 350 per day to around 500 per day. All of these efforts are due to close coordination with international partners and aid organizations to maximize our combined humanitarian efforts. We are cooperating with the United States Central Command in building a temporary floating pier on the coast of Gaza Strip, enabling aid to reach Gaza directly by sea. This humanitarian effort shows the depths of the United States-Israel strategic partnership and the shared values of our two nations. International airdrops of aid into Gaza are also continuing. So far, over 3,600 packages of food and essentials have been coordinated in 62 airdrops by several countries. This coordination is complicated, and it is complicated further by Hamas' ongoing fire, including towards aid convoys. We are working together with international organizations to solve the challenges of the distribution of aid inside Gaza. And we are implementing the lesson learned from the tragic incident with the WCK organization in order to maximize protection of aid workers and improve real-time cooperation of our humanitarian operations with international organizations. We've also reiterated our operational procedures regarding humanitarian aid convoys and workers with all our forces. As we have said, since day one, Israel is at war with Hamas, not the people of Gaza. Enabling humanitarian aid to reach Gazan civilians is a key part of our operations. It means that we can strengthen our efforts to bring home all our hostages and dismantle the terror Hamas organization. This week, the IDF troops were operating against Hamas terrorists in its Khan Yunus stronghold, completed their mission, and left Khan Yunus. This enables us to prepare for future operations to continue dismantling Hamas. And it also enables Gazans who moved from Khan Yunus to Rafah to return to Khan Yunus. We are working to establish new field hospitals, water, infrastructure, food, and shelter in set areas in central Gaza. The IDF will continue to do everything we can to bring back home our hostages and defeat Hamas, and also to make sure we continue to get as much humanitarian aid as possible into Gaza for the people of Gaza.
IDF spokesperson Daniel Hagari. Well, this past Sunday, April 7th, marked 6 months of the Gaza war. More than 1,200 people, mainly civilians, were killed on October 7th. 600 soldiers have been killed in the fighting. More than 100,000 Israelis have been forced to flee their homes from the Gaza periphery and along the northern border to mark the sixth anniversary of the Gaza war. Reporter Mark Weiss spoke with Itamar Ya'ar, former deputy head of the National Security Council and the head of Commanders for Israel Security, a nonpartisan movement of retired senior members of the defense establishment.
We went to war when we were not ready for it. But I think that the IDF and all the other organizations have done a relatively good job until now fighting. The situation is different now from what it was 6 months ago. First of all, most of the Hamas power disappeared or was destroyed. And this is one of the main aims of this war. We failed until now to reach and to achieve the other main goal is to release the hostages. Some of them were released, most of them didn't. And the time is working against them and against all the Israeli public. In terms of what is happening to the Palestinian population on the ground, I think that what had a good reason to destroy many, many places as part of the fighting against the Hamas activists in the first time, and only if it was very necessary, uninvolved people were suffered and some of them were killed as well. I think the situation now is different. I think that now the cause to fight the Hamas doesn't allow us to use the same tactics, and this is the reason, I believe, why the IDF recently is going and using other types of operations. Most of them are part of what we call special operations and not the heavy forces that we used in the past. I think that the main message that we get from the last half a year is that, first of all, the Palestinians will not disappear. Secondly, it's obvious that Israel will not control the Gaza Strip in the future. Thirdly, that those that will control it will be some kind of a Palestinian organization with the help of local regional forces. And I think that Israel failed until now to convince the international community and mainly the regional forces, the Arab forces of the region, that want to help us to go out of Gaza and to fight against Iran. We failed to do it.
So where do we go? Where do we go from here then? How do we stop being stuck in the Gaza quagmire? How do we turn tactical, local successes into a strategic victory? There are some who say now is the time to stop the fighting and close a deal with Hamas, whatever the price is, and it's, we know it's going to be a heavy price, as long as we can ensure that all the hostages are returned, those who are alive and those who are dead. And this will enable us to deal properly with the Northern Front, with the Lebanese border, something we haven't talked about, either by striking a deal with Hezbollah or by military means to push Hezbollah far from the border. Where do we go from now?
I fully agree with you that we need to go to a deal and to release the hostages. I'm not so sure that it's easy to do it, mainly because I believe, based on what we see in the last few months, that those that take the decisions in the Hamas, and this is Yahya Sinwar and him alone, he doesn't have an interest to release all the hostages. So we need to do whatever we can. We need to say that we are ready to pay the price. I hope that the other side will agree to it.
But and if not, part of it, if not, then what? Then we have to attack Rafah despite the very strong opposition from the U.S. to such a move?
Look, what had happened last week with the World Kitchen Organization, I think at least delayed dramatically any heavy operation in Rafah. I'm not so sure that we have the credibility and we will be able to do it in the next few months. And yes, the situation is difficult, and Israel need to pay the price and to cut the losses. And this is exactly the impression that I have. I am sorry to say that we could have do the same long ago, but we need to do it even now.
Israeli leaders, militarily and political leaders, keep threatening to attack Hezbollah in South Lebanon if there's no agreement there that will enable the 60,000 Israeli evacuees to return. Do you believe it's even possible for Israel to launch an attack on South Lebanon as long as the Gaza war is not completed?
The short answer is yes, the IDF can do it. The question is, what will be the price? It's obvious that as long as we and most of the IDF forces are in the south, the price of opening a real front of war, not fighting as it is now, but war in the north, will cause us many casualties among the civilians and among the military, because much of our forces need still to be in the south. Now, Israel doesn't have any interest to go to war in the north, because we all know that in the end of this war, we will not occupy Lebanon, we will not destroy Hezbollah, and even not closer to what we have done to the Hamas. So if you can reach an agreement in the north without going through a war, it's an Israeli interest. There is no doubt about it. But there is another question. And the other question is Iran. Because Iran don't give orders to Hezbollah, but Iran give advice to Hezbollah. And Iran is a heavy player, a very important player, every time that we speak about the North, every time that we speak about the Hezbollah. Altogether, I believe that to evacuate most of the Israeli population from the north was a big mistake. It was not done by the authorities. It was done by one of the chairmen of the local municipalities in the north that started it, and all the others followed in. I think that the population itself, most of people understood it, And this is the reason why many of them went back. I don't speak about Manara. I speak about most of the other places. What we need to do now, we need now to try to attack every Hezbollah position that we know about, step by step, not all of them together, to make sure and to try to achieve two main goals. One, to deter Hezbollah. Yes, you can deter Hezbollah from opening a full war because it's not Hezbollah and it's not Iran interest. Secondly, you need to do it, and this is what is happening in the last few months already, to make sure that you destroy one by one the Hezbollah positions along the border and even in the Baca Valley, to make sure that if we will have to go to war, all these facilities will not be part of that war.
Itamar Ya'ar, former deputy head of the National Security Council and head of Commanders for Israel Security. And now this song by Daniela Spector, Kol HaDvarim HaYafim Be'emet, All the True Real Things. Six months after the October 7th attack, much of the community of Kibbutz Nirim in the Gaza periphery has resettled temporarily in housing in Be'er Sheva. Longtime Kibbutz Nirim member Adele Ramier, a grandmother of Aid who is active in public diplomacy and who writes and speaks widely about life on Israel's southern border, spoke to our reporter Naomi Segel about the efforts to rebuild and to heal.
So you mean where does it find me on October 185th, 2023?
Yeah.
Stuck back in October, actually. My life was stolen from me on October 7th. And we've been through a lot since then, waiting to hear of loved ones who were captured, every so often getting more heartbreaking news of another hostage that will not be returning alive. We've been in my community, first was in Eilat, then we moved to Beersheba, which is a little bit closer to home at least, and not in the confines of a hotel, so a little bit more freedom, but working very hard on building resilience, building, trying to preserve community, which is not easy when, okay, we're in the same city at least, and not all kibbutzim are even in the same city, but we're spread out over four different neighborhoods. And it's not easy preserving community in that situation. And yeah, I've been abroad three times already, to the States twice and to Germany once, and planning more trips, both for public advocacy and fundraising, to so that we can rebuild our community, because we have to make it bigger and better and stronger and more attractive than ever before in order to encourage families with young children to move back there and new ones to come. Not everybody's going to be moving back. Mm-hmm. I will, but not everybody will. And we're going to need, we need to work really hard on that, because as I've said numerous times, if you give up on Kibbutz Nirim, you can give up on Israel.
Kibbutz Nirim members, as you mentioned, were murdered in the onslaught. Members are also still in Gaza.
Right.
And in addition, the kibbutz is trying to maintain, you say, a communal life. In this sense, most of the kibbutz is, at least in this more or less geographic proximity to one another?
So 70% of us are in Beersheba, and the rest are spread out in different areas of the country for different reasons. And I wouldn't call it a communal life, but a community life, because we are no longer the kibbutz of the 1940s and 50s. And 60s of total communal lives, but we do have a very strong sense of community, and we're trying to preserve that, because community builds resilience.
Have you been going to Nirim in this interim period at various times?
Mm. Yeah, I get to Nirim at least once a week. This week I'm going to be going there with my son, who was in the safe room with me on October 7th, although he does not live on Nirim anymore, but he was there with me in the safe room, and he was abroad for a few months after the October 7th attack, and has not been back to Nirim yet, and he wants to come to Nirim with me to sort of close circle, and we're going to sleep there. I slept there a couple of weeks ago for the first time. So he wants to also come back to Nirim and spend some time there reclaiming our home.
What
you
is
know, emotionally.
What is that feeling, being in that space? What do you see when you go to the kibbutz?
So most of the kibbutz looks good. It started around in November when there was a ceasefire on the hostage releases, that the team that works on landscaping started coming back to the kibbutz and cleaning things up and mowing the lawns. And they're there now every day. Like, people work on Nirim every day. You go to Nirim, you don't see a lot of people, but there are people who are working in the fields, and there are people who are working in the garage and working in the landscaping, and there's people around. You can't just abandon cows. In fact, Nirim was the only dairy that was up and milking within 24 hours of the attack. There were still terrorists running rampant around, and they were up and milking. So there's very much a presence there, but a lot of army. But, you know, I go there and it's so eerie because you don't hear any sounds of children.
It's not one of the communities where families have been permitted to move back. Is that correct?
No. And you can't bring kids back there. Kids who lived through October 7th and are still traumatized, you cannot bring them back to an area like that. You hear so many explosions on the other side of the border. And even, you know, I think it was yesterday, some of the communities have been allowed to come back, and there's a school that's up and running where the old school was in the Tsukhar area. And yesterday they had an incoming rocket alert when the kids were in school. And I just cannot imagine what those kids went through during that alert. They've worked so hard, 6 months working on trying to get your resilience back and not being scared that any minute there could be another incoming rocket. And then they're in school, not even with their parents. They're in school and they have to run for cover. So certainly for people who live in a community like mine that's so close to the border, you can't do that. We're not talking about returning until at least October. There's 25 houses that just need to be bulldozed and rebuilt. You can't go back to a kibbutz when not everybody has a home. We have to rebuild homes. We have to rebuild infrastructure, electricity, water that were destroyed. There's a lot of work to do before we could go home. So like I said, most of the kibbutz looks pretty good, but there are houses that are just all burnt and destroyed and have to be taken down. And there's 25 houses that just need to be bulldozed. Another 45 houses were seriously damaged, and it's not sure yet. It's not totally up to us. It's, you know, the insurance and everything have to be the ones that decide, is this building savable or does it have to be just torn down and rebuilt? So it's going to take a while. Although we were pioneers in 1946 when we were one of the Chadasre Nekudot, the 11 points that went out at the behest of David Ben-Gurion to settle the Negev in the middle of the night so that there would be a Jewish presence there when the state was founded. And we believe that we can be pioneers again and be among the first communities that are so frontline that we'll be able to get back and rebuild and reconstruct and reclaim what was stolen from us on October 7th.
What is important for you to have, probably security first and foremost, in order to feel you can move back?
Well, it has to be quiet. And I don't know exactly. I do not know what the government and what the army will need to do in order to regain the sense of security that I had on October 6th. The sense that I could go out. October 7th, I planned to wake up at 5:45 in the morning, take my camera in my car, drive out to the fields, and take pictures of a field of wildflowers at sunrise. I don't know what has to happen in order for me to be able to reclaim that sense of security, but what I do know is that it's going to have to be much more than just a sense, because as we saw on October 7th, that sense was not something that was truly tangible. It disappeared. It dissipated with the fog in the morning. So what they have to do in order to get that back, in order to enable me to get that back, I don't know. We're having kibbutz meetings on it now, on what we need in order to gain back our sense of security, our sense of resilience, under what conditions we will be able to move back as a community. We'll have to see. It's a process, and it's still got a ways to go.
And as you mentioned, each family has its considerations, but you sound certain, determined, you want to go back home.
The great majority of the people say that they want to go back home because it is our home. The question is when and under what circumstances.
Recently, I was driving back from that region on a Friday afternoon, and you pass one of the roadside shelters, which has the sign cleared, and next to it is a teenage boy sitting under one of these temporary shades selling flowers for Shabbat. And it really seemed sort of to hold the trauma and the hope in one place and in one hand, and that can be possible, that there can be a return for this,
mm-hmm.
for a quiet yeah. time and living in a place. But it doesn't eradicate the pain and the loss as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I worked on a project with those decorated art shelters that were decorated by the JNF. And I built a map of all of the shelters and curate pictures and information for the website about JNF. So when October 7th happened, I'm looking at the pictures and seeing all of these art shelters that Eliasaf Meira so lovingly designed, and JNF raised all this money to decorate them, to make these ugly bits of concrete into things of beauty in the middle of our landscape, and my heart just broke, and I'm trying to get back to it because Eliasaf is up and painting again. He's painting new shelters. What happens with the old ones will have to be decided. Whether to fix, you can't really erase scars. I don't know if you should really erase scars completely, but like there are tattoo artists that take people's scars and make them into a thing of beauty for their own healing. We're going to have to find a way to heal our scars and to use those as something on the one hand that will let us always remember, because October 7th can never, ever, ever happen again. But with resilience and looking forward to the future, for using that as a springboard for rebuilding.
Kibbutz Ne'eri member Adele Remer. An Israeli strike that killed 7 aid workers in Gaza drew sharp criticism from U.S. President Joe Biden and calls from some House Democrats to halt arms transfers to Israel pending an investigation. Reporter Naomi Segal asked Dr. Yonatan Freeman, an international relations expert at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem, if there were indications of a shift in the U.S. policy toward Israel in its conduct of the war against Hamas.
Well, I think that we have to understand that when it comes to friends, there can be disagreements. Just like there were disagreements when it came to the Iran nuclear deal, just when it came to disagreements when it comes to U.S.-Russian relations and Israeli-Russian relations vis-a-vis what's going on in the Ukraine. We've also had disagreements about Israeli-Chinese relations. So I think disagreements can always happen between friends. And I think if you look at this current war in Gaza, I think that we have not seen such a pro-Israel approach in terms of a current war that Israel has been fighting in modern times. I mean, even though we've been hearing some criticism, just like there could be any kind of criticism between the two sides, we're also hearing words by the U.S. administration that they want Hamas defeated. They want Israel to win. Above all, these criticisms aren't really leading to any sort of big policy changes. And I think that's the bottom line. What all push comes to shove when it comes to classifying what's going on between Washington and Jerusalem, what matters is not the statements, but the actual policies.
Right now, there are growing calls within Biden's own Democratic Party. Perhaps they started in the left flank, but now the former House Speaker, Nancy Pelosi, a staunch supporter of Israel, has added her voice of support to calls saying halt weapons supplies to Israel in the wake of these latest developments in the Gaza war.
Well, I think that when you look at these calls, we have to take into account that there's currently a very big election year going on in the United States. We know that there have been some protests in various cities in the United States. We know that some of these members of Congress represent audiences that from different towns and cities that might there might be some of these protests going on. But I think if you look at the overall support, it's still pretty strong. There are even voices in the Democratic Party who have been criticizing the criticism that some members of the U.S. administration has been have been raising. So I think looking at the big picture, it seems that there's still a very much a big support across the board when it comes to the Congress, when it comes to the leading members of the government in Washington. And any kind of calls about sanctions or stopping weapons from coming in, I think these are more of political spins. I don't see any sort of actual ability for these sort of calls to really lead into actual action. And just to give one example, with all the calls that have been made by these members, as you state, I have not heard of one call or a significant call by anyone in the United States who are saying we should also stop buying weapons from Israel. We should stop getting aid from Israel when it comes to different weapon systems and other things which the U.S. in the last few years has also been receiving from Israel as well.
So what kinds of conversations do you think are taking place behind those closed doors between the U.S. and Israel regarding the policy going forward?
Well, I think it's not a question of whether or not Israel should continue with the war as it sees fit, but I think it's more of discussions behind closed doors as to how it should continue. And we know that one of the issues has been humanitarian aid coming into Gaza. We know that, you know, as some people were reporting, that America is against an operation in Rafah. But now we're hearing that it's not about an operation in Rafah. It's about how the operation will take place in Rafah. So I think the issue of humanitarian aid, I think it's also in terms of discussions between the two countries, it could also be what will happen in Gaza the day after. And I think another discussion is really to make sure that this war doesn't expand into other areas, especially what's going on right now with Lebanon and Hezbollah and the fear that America might have that a further process in this war might lead to further kind of militant activity by Hezbollah, which will need a bigger Israeli response. And a war in Lebanon would obviously mean greater ramifications for American interests in the region.
So given all of this, would you say then that despite perhaps increasing voices that are being heard regarding some kind of change in the U.S. policy towards Israel, it's not at any kind of tipping point?
Yeah, I think it's not a tipping point. I think that in the end, Israel has a lot of leeway. I think that Israel of today and the war in Gaza, compared to previous operations, I think that Israel is at a higher standing in terms of its ability to decide when it wants to fight and when it wants to end the fight. And I think that obviously when it comes to American pressure or American requests, I think that that could play a role in trying to maybe explain to the public later on why the war had to stop or why we couldn't do this or we couldn't do that because, you know, there's other ramifications and different things that we have to take into account internationally. But I think in the end, America understands, especially because of the results on the 7th of October, that no country would be able to stop itself from responding in a way that Israel has. I think that America understands that. And I think America knows that it can maybe advise Israel on how it should fight. It can't advise Israel on why it should fight.
Dr. Yonatan Freeman of the Hebrew University of Jerusalem. Well, that concludes our program. Thanks for listening. This is Aryeh O'Sullivan wishing you a good evening and Shavua Tov. And we leave you with this song by Yuval Dayan, Ad Shetachzor, Until You Return. Shambenari, Venkfari.
עובר שדות פתוחים מלאים בטות וריח גשם מתגבר עוד הצעיף שלי על צווארך שומר מפני רוחות מזרח קרות הלוואי השמש תחמר